Cato the Younger is one of the least documented of Julius Caesar's opponents in comparison to equally notable Romans of his time like Pompey and Brutus. However, Cato's principles and politics have managed to survive the centuries and are heavily rooted in the foundations of this country. Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney, both former political speechwriters, look into his life and his ideas in their new book called Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having
Rob,
us.
Rob, is this the first modern biography on Marcus Porcius Cato?
Yes, it is. To the best of our knowledge, I'm going to say, in case someone puts an asterisk on. But in fact, Cato was very well known and very well documented in his time. He was lionized by people like Cicero and Plutarch, but he really fell into disfavor in more recent times. So we're trying to restore Cato's reputation, restore the sense of his importance both to Roman history and to our own history.
And why has he fallen into disfavor?
There's a variety of reasons. We think the foremost of which is that Cato, unlike many of his contemporaries, didn't write anything down. So, you know, Caesar sends home third-person histories of himself. Cicero writes these long philosophical tracts, many of which are preserved. And the only written document we have from Marcus Porcius Cato is a letter that he wrote to Cicero. And we only have it because Cicero preserved it. So it's much harder to construct a story when you don't have somebody's own writing to go on.
But Plutarch wrote about Cato.
Yes, Plutarch did. He came a little more than a century after Cato's death, and Plutarch was a really important biographer of the height of the Roman Empire during the time of the Emperor Hadrian. Plutarch was Greek. He was very familiar with Stoicism, which is the philosophy or religion that Cato really put in the mainstream of Roman life. But again, we think that Plutarch, even though he didn't know Cato, was really working from the sources of people who did know Cato, such as Cato's secretary and his friend Cicero.
But when you are using ancient texts as source material, how can you be certain what is accurate, what isn't? How can you separate fact from fiction?
You know, it's the challenge for anybody who writes about the period, but what you try to do is take an individual event or instance and triangulate. So you look to three different sources who are saying maybe the same thing or competing things about a given instance in Cato's life, and then you make, based on that and the academic research, you make the educated guess, and you do the best you can with the sources you have. The sources are limited, but you do the best you can with what you have.
So you worked for the Clinton administration? Is that why you're engaging triangulation here? You mentioned that that Cato was a Stoic. What effect did that have on the way he lived his life?
Well, the idea of Stoicism is essentially that one of the ideas is that you are responsible for your own happiness. The external world is entirely beyond your control, but what happens on the inside, how you respond to events, what emotions and sensations you agree to or disagree to is totally within your control. It's a philosophy of hardiness, and that really served Cato well in the ups and downs of political life.
But it is a Greek philosophy. Was it adopted by a lot of Romans as well?
It was actually considered sort of this odd foreign import. We liken it to kind of it's the equivalent of something like Scientology in the way that it's thought of in the mainstream, right?
In
ancient Rome. And so Cato is actually the person who makes it okay to be a Stoic in public because some Stoic teachings were a little out there, but the things that he adopts, the things that Romans see him doing, seem perfectly within the Roman character.
But Romans borrowed so many things from the Greeks. Was Stoicism just something that they saw as totally foreign to their way of life, their culture?
They did borrow a tremendous amount of their culture from the Greeks, but you have to remember that Cato is rising in Roman politics in a time when this process is underway. Roman society is changing more in Cato's lifetime than it had ever really changed before. So this creates tremendous cultural upheaval. So what Cato is able to do is, on the one hand, paint himself as a hardy, noble Roman out of the ancient past, but on the other hand, integrate that with this philosophy that's essentially a newish borrowing and show how those two things can be united in the same person.
My guests are Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney. Their book, Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the odder aspects of Cato's Stoicism was how it ended his marriage to Marcia, his second wife. What happened there, Jimmy?
So this is one of the peculiar instances in his life, and it also reveals a lot about Cato because it shows how far he's willing to follow these principles. there's a man named Hortensius, a friend of his, an older friend, who comes to Cato and says, I do not have a male heir, and I want that male heir, so I'm going to I offer my hand in marriage to your daughter. Cato says, well, unfortunately, my daughter is married, and I don't want to end that marriage, so that's a no-go. So then Hortensius says, well, what about your wife? And Cato thinks for a moment and says, well, that makes perfect sense. And it only makes perfect sense if you abide by the Stoic principle that the purpose of marriage and the purpose of family is to create male heirs who are worthy of running the state. And so what he does is he divorces his wife, he walks her down the aisle to the altar, he gives her to Hortensius, they get married, and if everybody is getting a little puzzled, the Romans were puzzled too. They thought this was very peculiar.
Do we know what Marcia thought about all of this? After all, didn't she have some say in this whole process?
Unfortunately, to the best of our knowledge, she didn't. I think that's part of the problem about doing history and reporting on times that were much more patriarchal than ours. Not only were they patriarchal, but the views of women, unfortunately, weren't recorded to nearly the degree that Cato's view was recorded.
You mentioned that the Roman Republic never had what we would recognize as political parties. What would you call a group like the Optimates?
They were the equivalent of factions, right? They were much looser than political parties. They didn't have headquarters. They didn't have a deliberate platform. They had loose affiliations through ties of marriage, ties of friendship, ties of warfare that kept these groups together. But the Optimates can be thought of as kind of the conservative faction of Roman politics.
And were other members of the Optimates Stoics?
Cato was really the leading Stoic in Rome, and Stoicism was beginning to gain some traction. Cicero, who was politically sympathetic to Cato, was also sympathetic to Stoicism, although he was never quite as on board as Cato was. But Cato was really not only Rome's leading conservative, but Rome's leading Stoic.
So would he be a conservative today?
Well, it's really hard to track ancient politics onto modern politics because the issues are so different. But we think that one thing that would last about Cato is his disposition. He is someone that harkens back to the ancient past. He's someone who believes that politics really flows from personal morality. And he's also someone that is famous for being so utterly uncompromising.
He'd probably take a literal reading of the Constitution. We suspect he might be sympathetic to people like Antonin Scalia. So that's about
on the other hand, considering how modestly he lived, would he have been a supportive of poor people and greater equality?
Well, there's one really interesting moment in Cato's life when Cato actually dramatically expands the size of the Roman welfare state, which at the time was basically the public provision of grain so that people could eat at a cheaper price. But Cato doesn't really do this out of principle. He does this because Rome is just coming off of a near revolution led by the radical leader Catiline that Cato and Cicero are able to help suppress. But Cato thinks the state is so threatened that he really needs to send a sop to the lower classes in Rome, not really because he sympathized with them, because the issue of his austerity, of his deliberate poverty, those were more personal principles for him. It wasn't really out of sympathy. It was out of making himself as hard and stubborn as possible.
I've always been a bit confused about the business of calling these people the elder and the younger. Mm-hmm. Pliny the elder, Cato the younger, that meant... But he's not a junior. There were other Catos who
he's,
were
he's
famous?
He's not a junior. So Cato the Elder is Cato the Younger's great-grandfather, and Cato the Younger tried to model his life after his great-grandfather. His great-grandfather was famous for the same kind of adherence to principle, the same kind of implacable stubbornness, and he is famous for the expression Carthago dolendo est, Carthage must be destroyed, which he used to end every speech no matter what it was about. He was a giant in his own time, and his great-grandson set out to emulate his great-grandfather.
And he's also wanted to eradicate Christianity, didn't he?
Well, not Christianity, but really the Greek influence. There's actually a great story when the first Greek delegation of philosophers comes to Rome in the time of Cato the Elder, Cato's great-grandfather. They create a youth sensation. I mean, it's hard to imagine youths lining up to go to philosophy lectures, but this was a big cultural hit in Rome. Cato the Elder is so offended by this that the first thing he does using his authority as a senator is to pack them back on a boat directly to Greece post-haste. So there's actually a quote from, I think it's Pliny, who says that Cato the Elder expelled the Greeks, and Cato the Younger, in the form of Stoicism, helped bring them back.
Well, you get the feeling that Cato the Younger also was very anti-authoritarian, but...
He was anti-dictatorship.
And, he was a nonconformist. He was very big on making himself almost deliberately laughable because he thought of this as a way of testing himself, testing his commitment to what he thought was really important.
How did the rule of Sulla affect Cato and influence his future?
So Cato was a child when Sulla became dictator and essentially began a mass bloodletting that Cato was witness to. So Sulla takes a shine to Cato because Cato excels in a boys' game where they're testing the potential for future leadership. So Sulla sits Cato right next to him on the couch as people are brought forward and Sulla's deciding whether or not they're going to live or die. And our sense is that this mass bloodletting affected an entire generation of Roman politicians. It almost couldn't have not affected them. And for Cato, it makes him a very strict adherent to rules, to principles, to the idea of the Constitution, and to the fear of one-man rule.
And I was going to say that the fascinating thing is that the generation that ends the Republic, Cato, Cicero, Julius Caesar, all come of age in this era shaped by Sulla's mass killings. So as much as they want to resist the return of civil war to Rome, there is this sensation as the Republic comes to an end, oh my God, we're going through it again. We meant to stop it, and it just happened again. What could we have done to prevent this?
Now, we know little about Caesar's childhood as well, right? Do we know how he reacted to Sulla?
Well, we know a little bit. I believe that Sulla actually attempted to break up Julius Caesar's marriage. Julius Caesar resisted this because he at the time felt a very close bond to his wife, stood up to Sulla. Sulla was so taken by this that he actually let Julius Caesar go, but he made a remark. Sulla's enemy at the time was Marius. Caesar was related to Marius, and Sulla was heard to remark after Caesar left, "Watch that boy. He has many a Marius in him." Mm-hmm. It turned out to be a very good prediction.
Did Caesar and Cato know each other well?
They knew each other quite well.
How had they met?
I think the initial meeting so they're in a very small circle of the elite. Presumably they knew of each other because of their family line. So their families went way back. But their first significant confrontation is in the Senate when they argue over national security and whether or not a group of homegrown terrorists should be executed.
Wait a minute. This is how far BC?
It has some odd resonances today because...
And wait, what was Cato's position? What was Julius Caesar's position?
So Cato says that the homegrown terrorists should be executed, but Caesar delivers his speech first. And Caesar says that clemency is the best tradition of the ancient Romans, and we ought to jail them, but we ought not to kill them. And he has the entire Senate swayed. And then Cato stands up and says, "Do you have any idea what is going on? This is a threat that requires immediate action, and we need to execute all of them." And Cato essentially attacks the senator's manhood and calls them weak and manages to win the day, and the conspirators are executed.
And from this moment, Caesar really recognizes that in Cato he has an enemy who is really his equal in eloquence, in force of character, in lineage, in ability to command an audience. He singles out Cato as the person that is going to stand in the way of his rise more than really any other figure in Roman life.
How was the Senate arranged in those days? Since they weren't parties, you say there were groups of like-minded people. But was there some sense of hierarchy?
Well, the Senate was an aristocracy. So first of all, it was drawn from the absolute top of Roman society, and senators served for life. Once you were elected to an office of a magistracy, like the quaestor, who was a treasury position, you also became a member of the Senate for your entire life. But really, leadership in the Senate was not formalized. It was simply on the basis of authority. So if you were known as the head of the Senate or the leader of your faction, this was not something that people voted on. It was simply a matter of how much acclaim they gave to you. And Cato, really, in winning this debate over the Catiline conspiracy, over terrorism that Jimmy talks about, really takes on the leadership of the Senate's conservative faction just because so much of that faction begins to respect his personal authority.
My guests are Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney. Their book, Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar, published by Thomas Dunn Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Jimmy Soney, S-O-N-I, and Rob Goodman. Their book, Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. How did the two of you decide to collaborate on a book about Cato?
You know, we were debate partners at Duke University as undergrads, and so I was reading a book called Rubicon by Tom Holland, and on the basis of that book, I went and bought a biography of Caesar, I bought a biography of Cicero, and I went out looking for a biography of Cato, and I didn't find one. And I remembered back from our debate days that Rob quoted Roman history, loved Roman history as much as I did. And so I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, I think we can work on this together.
And you both have worked as speechwriters in Washington?
That's right. You know, actually, as we were writing this book, we were both practicing speechwriters. So we'd work all day. We'd meet at 7:30 or 8 in Jimmy's little tiny basement apartment, and we would get to work on this book for a few hours every night.
Is that why the people you wrote for kept on quoting from the great Roman orators?
Well, not quite as much as I would have liked.
Right.
Cato was passionate about fighting corruption during his time in political office. Was he punished for that by being sent to be overseer to the annexation of Cyprus?
Well, in a way, Cato wasn't so much punished for that as he was punished for running afoul of the wrong people. And that really is of a piece with the way he resisted corruption. Cato really thought that Rome was suffering from a moral downfall that reflected itself in an obsession with money and an obsession with conspicuous consumption.
Of his stoicism.
It does, yeah. And it comes out of his traditional Romanness, too. And he thought it was corrupting elections as well. He just thought there was too much money in the entire system. So when he runs afoul of Clodius, who's a more populist leader, not so much on the issue of corruption in Roman life, but really on the issue of Clodius being an ally of Caesar and an ally of Cato's other enemies, Clodius essentially says, well, Cato, you can have this wonderful job. It's overseas. Go to Cyprus for 2 years and get out of Roman politics. And Cato, because he is such a stickler for law and order, even though he understands that he's being set up, he's essentially being sent into exile, he has to accept because Cato's entire persona is following the laws that exist.
But he also thinks he can make a good example and deal with transparency, something.
Yeah.
So many of these things are issues today. It's just amazing.
Nothing changes.
So the sad fact is that he does. He does an extraordinary job. He adheres to the law while he's abroad in Cyprus. He manages to sell off various assets in a fastidious way. He catalogs everything. And then, you know, the joke ends up being on him because he loses the records on the way back that attest to the fact that he adhered to all the rules. And then suddenly he's accused by his enemies of corruption.
He brings silver back to the treasury, but that comes back to haunt him during the civil war with Caesar.
Remarkably, it does, because one of Caesar's first moves once he crosses the Rubicon and starts the civil war is to march on Rome and seize the treasury. A lot of the money that Caesar seized in the Roman treasury was money that Cato had extracted from Cyprus. So Cato unintentionally ends up funding the campaign of his enemy.
A listener wonders if you've seen the HBO series Rome, and is it historically accurate when it deals with people like Caesar and Cato?
We've seen bits and pieces, and it is fairly historically accurate. I was actually surprised by the accuracy. But the one thing it gets wrong is it makes Cato out to be this curmudgeonly old guy. And the truth is, he's about the same age as Caesar. I think they were exactly the same age. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's easy to write somebody who's a little bit of a prig and a little bit of a stickler as this old guy who goes around pointing fingers and telling everybody how they could do things better.
But Cato always seemed older than his years, almost his entire life. And even his close contemporaries in Roman times, when they were depicting Cato, would depict him as this old man with white hair and a long beard, even though he never really got old enough to turn his hair white.
Well, one of the things you get from that series is that families played a major role. What family you came from, and the whole matter of marriage and blood. Many people found themselves caught in competing situations during the Civil War. What was the purpose of marriage in Rome? Was it just to create family alliances?
We say that it was politics by other means, right? So marriages enabled strategic alliances. So you could give away your daughter in order to cement a bond that, you know, needed some support.
Or give away your wife.
Or give away your, give away your wife if you're Cato.
Was it difficult to get a divorce?
Not that hard, actually. Surprisingly, Roman had some very liberal divorce laws. So, for instance, people like Pompey and Caesar could be married four or five times as the political wind shifted.
And by the time of Cato, they've actually reformed the laws further to enable women to keep property during divorces, that kind of thing. So the laws are actually becoming more liberal during Cato's time.
But little is ever written about the wives of these men. Did women ever play a role in politics? I mean, other than behind the scenes?
It was largely behind the scenes, but it was incredibly important. So there's an amazing moment when there's actually a few amazing moments. But in the middle of accusing Caesar of some kind of treachery, Caesar gets a note, and Cato stands up in the middle of the Senate. He's like gone on at length about how terrible Caesar is, and he says, "Well, that note, that's a note from some conspirator that he's working with." And Caesar hands him the note, and he looks at it, and he flings it back at him and says, "Take it, you drunk." And the note is a love note from Cato's half-sister to Caesar. So, you know, there are these moments where women manage to affect politics in profound ways. Cato ends up deep. We imagine that given that Caesar was sleeping with just about every woman in Roman life, that he certainly slept with Cato's half-sister. He may have even slept with Cato's wife. And you could sort of hear in the historical record this kind of furious tone underneath it all.
Now, during the Civil War, which family was a woman obligated to serve or to side with, her husband's or her parents?
Well, in general, hopefully, if she was married off by the family, there wouldn't be that kind of conflict. But
well, or her lover.
Or her lover.
In the case of Julius Caesar.
Right. But there certainly were conflicts. And the one conflict I can think of is not the case of a woman, but of a man, a Brutus, who is very close to Julius Caesar after the Civil War. But at the same time, he's Cato's son-in-law. So he's a person of divided loyalties. Of course, he ends up leading the conspiracy that assassinates Caesar. And we think that in doing this, he's really acting, he's repudiating his friendship with Caesar and acting as Cato's heir, carrying out the principles that Cato would have wanted to carry out had he lived.
Well, in the time leading up to Caesar's march on Rome, what was the mood of the general public? Did any fear Caesar's intentions?
It was mass panic. I mean, the city itself was essentially convulsing for days, weeks on end, months on end, really, because in a move that we try to piece together and understand, the Senate leadership decides to abandon Rome. And so families are torn apart. The Senate flees. They send different senators to different places with different pieces of the army. They neglect to take any money out of the treasury, which you still can't understand. But families are torn apart. And everybody fears Caesar's arrival, but part of that is that the hysteria sort of, you know, it increases disproportionate to the threat.
Yeah, well,
right?
Wasn't he considered forgiving and pretty fair?
He was. That was a huge part of Caesar's persona. He was the merciful conqueror. He was not going to reenact the bloodletting that was caused when Sulla took over Rome.
So when everybody started, when the Senate fled Rome, where did Cato go?
Cato, I believe he initially went to take up a command in the Mediterranean, but immediately afterwards he followed over to Pompey's army, who is in, what was Illyria, which is now Albania or Eastern Europe, to be present at the battles between Pompey and Caesar. Although, of course, at the decisive battle, Pompey, who's really threatened by Cato's authority and threatened by Cato's leadership, tells Cato to sit on the sidelines. This is really what temporarily saves Cato's skin and keeps him from being caught up in the huge defeat that Caesar ultimately inflicts on Pompey.
But his personality prevents him from outmaneuvering his opponents, doesn't it?
It's often that the personality leads him to do things that are directly in contrast to his goals. So he runs from power at the precise moment when power could be most useful in saving the Republic. And it's often on weird constitutional arguments. At one point, there's the possibility that there's somebody new that needs to take over the army. And everyone swarms to Cato and says, "You're the most effective military leader. You've seen battle. You know how to lead troops. You should be the guy to do this." And he says, "I'd love to. But the Constitution says that guy needs to do it. And never mind that guy's a half-wit, doesn't know how to lead troops to save his life. It's going to happen because the Constitution deems it so."
So he's a strict constructionist.
Absolutely.
That's probably the best way to interpret him.
And what Cato essentially says is that the right of this person to take command because he has precedence over me is exactly what we're fighting for. What we're fighting for is rules of precedence, no extraordinary commands, no bending the law for anyone, not even me. So even though he is extremely principled in putting himself aside, it really at the very end dooms his own cause and leads indirectly to his defeat and suicide.
My guests are Rob Goodman and Jimmy Soney. Their book, Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. You call him Rome's Last Citizen because he took these positions on constitutionality?
Well, you know, the category of citizen kind of outlives Cato, but we call him Rome's Last Citizen in part because, you know, he is the last serious challenge to Caesar and the last serious challenge to Caesar's leadership before the dictatorship begins.
You don't think that Caesar would have pardoned Cato?
I think he would have enjoyed pardoning Cato more than, you know, we can possibly imagine. The idea of pardoning Cato meant that Cato could then just become this tolerated senatorial crank. He could become this guy who's in the shadows, who stands up in filibusters, but has no real authority. Cato didn't want to give Caesar the privilege of pardoning him.
Is that why he killed himself?
That's one of the reasons why he kills himself.
Right. He's also a Stoic. Does that play a role in it?
Part of it does. Part of it does is the idea that Stoicism essentially means being impervious to pain. So Cato had no issue with not only killing himself, but then disemboweling himself when the initial attempt to kill himself didn't work. But in doing that, he was doing a couple of things. He was sending the message that Caesar could not pardon him, that Caesar didn't have the authority to pardon him, and also that Caesar's victory was not just the temporary victory of a faction, but was the death of everything that Rome represented.
It sounds like the kind of obsession with honor that we know from the stories of the samurai.
Very much so. And I think they killed themselves in the same way, through a disembowelment.
Did he have supporters after he died? Was he mourned by many Romans?
Oh, very much so. In fact, Caesar, in trying to rewrite the history of Cato and make him seem subhuman for essentially ripping his own stomach open, he puts out a float, essentially a big painting of Cato doing this, and it's this really gruesome scene. And he thinks what it's going to elicit is disgust from people, like, oh, that's Cato, that we can never follow him. Instead, the crowd boos and they cry because they mourn Cato. And right away, there's this battle to control Cato's legacy, with Caesar on the one side and people like Cicero on the other.
Now, what about the legacy afterward? He had an impact on early Christians, but also on George Washington. Can you talk about some of the – because to me, Cato – is a very conflicted character. I'm not sure whether to admire him all the time or to feel that he was too true to his ideals, the sort of thing that we are now debating in this country, whether sticking to your ideology no matter what is always the best approach.
Well, I'll tell you what, you expressed that uncertainty about Cato. That's exactly how we feel, and we tried to write that into the book because we very much see what made him so principled and honorable, and we also see what made him self-destructive and ineffective. But the interesting thing about Cato is that his life demonstrates that even if you go to extraordinary lengths to shake your public legacy in a way that Cato did, after you're dead, you become an object. You become used for other people's political causes. As Jimmy said, this happens to Cato immediately after he dies, but as you said, he's also a popular figure for the Christians because Cato becomes so canonized in Roman life years and years after he was dead that in order to establish their way of life as a superior one to the pagan way of life, the Christians have to attack Cato as someone who is consumed with vanity, as someone who killed himself out of spite, as someone who was all about worldly pride and not about self-sacrifice. So the Christians really stage a centuries-long attack on Cato that keeps his name alive but also really throws him down in the mud.
So, but why was George Washington inspired in the opposite way by Cato?
Well, George Washington essentially wanted to become Cato. He wanted to transform himself into Cato. So George Washington grows up reading and enjoying and loving a play called Cato, A Tragedy in Five Acts, that was written by Joseph Addison. We don't have accurate statistics for this, but by some measurements, it's the most successful play in American life until Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. And it was a sensation during the American Revolution. Every learned man of the day was expected to have read and even memorized this play. Lines like, "Give me liberty or give me death," from Patrick Henry, actually come from this play. When Nathan Hale is about to be hung by the British for treason, he's a 21-year-old army captain who's been captured, and the British are about to hang him, and they ask him if he has any last words, and he says the famous line, "I regret that I have but one life to give for my country." That is a line from the play. So the last words of this dying man are from this play. And George Washington himself was so inspired by it that he had had the play staged at Valley Forge in the winter of 1776.
As a way of saying, we have to remain as stoical as possible in this time where we look like we may be defeated.
Right, and we have to resist to the point of death. Cato became a symbol of a lot of things, but in the revolutionary generation, he was first and foremost the symbol of liberty and of unbending defense of liberty in the face of immense odds.
And the founders were really nice to themselves. They used to refer to themselves as the American Cato, and other people used to refer to them that way too. So John Adams, I think, refers to himself as the American Cato. Samuel Adams refers to himself as the American Cato. People call George Washington the American Cato. It was a little bit of flattery for them.
We have just moments left, but Rob, you're a former speechwriter for the House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer and also Senator Chris Dodd.
That's right.
And you decide that wasn't enough? You had to write a book about an ancient Roman?
I'll tell you what, one thing that I really loved working in politics and working on this book was the way that they informed each other. So, for instance, when you're working in politics, it's a great job, but on the one hand, you really have to stick to talking points. So being able to explore the history like this and then use it to go back and inform my work on the Hill, I think it made both things richer. It was really good brain exercise.
Jimmy, you don't list who you've written speeches for.
Yeah, I was working for the mayors of Washington, D.C. So I worked for two mayors of Washington, Adrian Fenty and Vincent Gray.
And you're also now managing editor of the Huffington Post Media Group.
Mm-hmm. I work at the Huffington Post. And it's actually been interesting to work in media while doing the book because you can see how certain public messages do and don't get traction.
Well, one other thing that we have very little time to discuss, Cato's position on filibuster.
Well, Cato virtually invented the filibuster. He was well known for talking from dawn to dusk to stop bills that he objected to. But one of the lessons we draw from this book is that while this gave Cato immense success in the short term, it was a very unstable strategy. Cato's enemies united against him, joined forces to basically put an end to Cato's filibusters, and formed what's known as the First Triumvirate, which was the alliance that essentially ends the Republic.
So and does really Mitch McConnell know about this?
I was going to say, we're really hoping the 100 members of the Senate decide to pick up this book before the holiday season ends.
We thank you both so much for being on our show, Rob Goodman, Jimmy Soni. The book, Rome's Last Citizen, The Life and Legacy of Cato, Mortal Enemy of Caesar. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books, part of St. Martin's Press. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.